connecting actions to consequences can best be effective when there's little time in between. Well, that's often the advice to parents, and it's increasingly becoming the dictum of advocates for change in programs to stem juvenile crime. Hawaii Island prosecutor Mitch Roth is among them. It's why he's trying to expand the program he began on the east side of the island to its west side community. We spoke recently about the program and the kids it serves.
The juveniles in our juvenile justice system are generally between the ages of 14 and 18. So it's a very small group. Generally, if they're younger than that, they don't come into the criminal justice system.
So is it a misnomer to say kids when we're really talking about teens?
We're really talking mostly about teens.
What kind of crime gets them in trouble?
Well, a little bit of everything from, you know, theft to violence, drugs, drinking. There's a whole bunch of crimes that kids can be committing that could get them into trouble.
When they do get into trouble, some of your longtime criticism has been that there's just too much time that elapses between what happens when they commit the crime, even when they're confronted with what they've done, and seeing any real consequences from it. That seems to really thwart how parenting, or at least good parenting, is supposed to be modeled, isn't it?
Exactly. When a kid does something or when anybody does something, you want to take action quickly. And it's not always, you know, putting them in jail or locking them up, but you want to address the problem. I have three kids, and if you let it go and nothing happens, what is the message you're teaching them? And that's been the problem in, you know, Hawaii County, and I think the rest of the state as well, is that, you know, kids would get arrested. The police have a limited amount of time, I believe it's 6 hours, to make a charge. Oftentimes they don't do that charge within 6 hours because there's still investigation that needs to be done. The juvenile gets released, and, you know, 6-7 months later, they're coming to the court for the first time. A lot of times kids, they don't really think about, you know, what got them into trouble in the first place. And it's hard to give a good learning lesson if you're waiting 6-7 months, or a lot of times when they're getting sentenced, like a year. It doesn't create good teachable moments.
So the de facto message is, you can do something and effectively nothing's going to happen for quite a while, and the longer it goes on, the less they really understand the consequence of their actions, especially because kids don't get into, and I want to maybe say not kids, but teens especially, haven't really gotten the idea that there are consequences. I mean, their brains are still developing. Their ability to understand and to assign consequential thought doesn't really happen until they get into their 20s. Do we take into account any of these issues when kids are then involved with crime and the juvenile justice system?
Well, you know, oftentimes we do. I mean, there's a lot of diversion programs that are out there, and generally if it's a minor crime, the cases are going to be diverted throughout the state, not just to Hawaii County, but wherever you are, they pretty much get diverted. When they start reoffending and, you know, you're starting to see patterns, then they'll end up in the criminal justice system. And that's because we haven't really had that good teachable moment.
You'd like to have more of those teachable moments, both with the existing program that's on the east side of the island now expanding into the West Hawaii Island area. What exactly does it mean to have that expansion happen? What will be available there as you have available on the east side?
So let's talk a little bit about what that program is. It is the Big Island Juvenile Intake and Assessment Center, BIJAC as we call it. And what happens before BIJAC and what happens on the west side of the island is the police will make an arrest, and like we talked about, the kids will go free for a while, and it could be 6-7 months before, you know, something's happening on the court end. With BIJAC, the police pick up the youth, they bring them over to the BIJAC, they do an assessment, they find out what kind of services are needed. Once they find out what kind of services are needed, you know, then they start matching them up with those services. The sooner we can get the youth into services, the sooner the youth gets that recognition, that teachable moment that you can't be doing what they're doing. And we're finding some great successes with that.
I think your point is that the sooner they get into it, the sooner you're able to assess a pattern if there is one or prevent one from happening. Do you have numbers to be able to back up of reoffending?
Yeah, so what we've seen is several hundred kids or several hundred youth who've gone through BIJAC. We've seen very little recidivism. I believe the recidivism rate is hanging somewhere around 5%. the cost for the BiJack is about $750 to $900 per youth. Now, if you compare that with the Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility, HYCF, our kids' prison, as we call it, we know that the cost per kid is about $200,000 a year. And the success rates from what we've seen as published is somewhere around 25% or a 75% recidivism rate versus the BiJack, which is a 95% success rate with a 5% recidivism rate. You know, a lot of these kids, like we talked about earlier, their brains are developing and they probably won't be involved in the criminal justice system later on. But if you're able to get in there quickly, and a lot of the services that we're talking about, sometimes they're family counseling, dealing with the families. You know, you talk to people in the criminal justice system, whether you're talking to the judges or the public defenders or the prosecutors or the probation officers, many times they're going to tell you it really is what's going on in the household that's bringing these kids into the court. We know that there's studies that, one of the studies is called the ACEs studies that looks at domestic violence in a household and what results that have. We know, for example, that kids coming from homes of domestic violence are 6 times more likely to commit suicide than kids not coming from homes of domestic violence. Suicide is one of our major problems that we're having in Hawaii right now. You don't see them too much in the press, but we're losing a lot of people, a lot of kids to suicide. Other things that we know, kids who come from homes of domestic violence are 24 times more likely to be involved with sex assault, either as offenders or as victims. And the other thing, looking at the same group of kids, just to go on, a lot of times people talk about crime, they say, oh, it's all about drugs. Well, we know that kids coming from homes of domestic violence are 50% more likely to abuse drugs or alcohol than kids not from homes of domestic violence. I mean, that's some pretty staggering statistics when you think about it. Also, when you look at the other crimes, burglaries, drugs, and stuff like that, again, about 50 to 60 times more likely to be involved with those kinds of crimes than kids not coming from homes of domestic violence. So if you can get assessments done and start working on the family, because sometimes, like I said, it's really not the kids. They may have a drug issue, but the drug issue is a symptom of other problems that's going on with the youth's life.
All of what you've just talked about points to the fact that these issues are connected and that we can't look at them in isolation because they don't exist in a vacuum. It also points to the fact that there's also a great deal of money that's being wasted, perhaps, by having kids go off to prison and not go into a program like BiJack. Is there a way of being able to extend this beyond Hawaii Island and see this as being the new normal?
Yeah, well, it is starting to be extended on. There's an assessment center on Oahu. They do things a little bit different than they do it on the Big Island. But it's also looking not just at assessment centers. It's looking at how we're going to deal with youth and how we're going to deal with the families and actually getting to the source of problems. I say that, you know, as we speak, we're getting ready for a camp on the Big Island called Camp Agape. Camp Agape is a camp for kids whose parents are incarcerated. We know that kids coming from incarcerated parents have a 50% likelihood to be involved with the criminal justice system. So we have Camp Agape is now on all of the islands. They're done through the churches, and you know, we're helping out on the Big Island to, you know, work with these kids. Because we've seen some huge changes from kids who've gone to this camp. So it's not just one little thing. There's a whole bunch of things that are working. We're working differently in our court system throughout the state on how we're going to deal with kids and you know, what kind of services they're getting.
I want to thank you, Mitch Roth, for the time today.
Thank you very much, Beth Ann.
Mitch Roth is the prosecuting attorney for the County of Hawaii. He's working to extend a juvenile crime program to West Hawaii Island.
Thank you.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a look at great ideas in ecologically focused design and figuring out how to get them done here. But first, your backyard quiz.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaho olave, ohamaiti.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're heading to the Big Island up the Kaiopuna Trail off the Chain of Craters Road. Our destination? The Pu'uloa Petroglyphs in Volcanoes National Park. There are 23,000 hand-carved images, there. It's really the largest collection of petroglyphs in Polynesia. Now, there are representations of humans, animals, abstract shapes, and you might be surprised to find out that most of the carvings are just simple pukas. So what were those holes for? The question attracted the attention of anthropologist Martha Beckwith. And in 1914, she wrote, "For Native Hawaiians, the site was more than just a canvas on which to make a mark. It was also a place to record the births of children and to seek long life for them. Each puka represented a birth, and as a family grew, so did its cluster of pukas." But the story doesn't stop there. Beckwith also learned that the tradition included placing a certain object in the puka after it was chiseled. For today's quiz, can you name that object? If you can, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Aloha, this is Laura Thielen. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Today, over half the world's population lives in cities, and that percentage is growing every day. Urbanism is something we've really got to get right in Hawaii. And that's part of why the Building Voices Design Symposium presented by the UH Manoa School of Architecture was so interesting. It aimed at airing great international ideas in ecologically focused design. Now, we've got a couple of planning committee members here. Landscape architect Simon Bussier. He teaches up at UH Manoa, focusing on ecological urban design and communication. Also, architect Carla Sierralta, who teaches up at UH. She was part of a design competition for the Building Voices Symposium. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Noe.
And let's zero right in on that design competition, because you brought in international ideas for ecological design.
Aloha. Thank you for having us. We had 111 visionary proposals that were submitted to the competition. And the competition was launched in February, and in April, we had a jury of notable community members that were that was a jury, including design leaders, academics, public officials. They selected three winners, six honorable mentions, and eight citations. And the jury included acting director of rural studio at Auburn University, a strategist from Amazon, a senior experienced researcher at Uber, and also included architects, landscape architects, artists.
It was an esteemed group. What a jury. Okay.
It was incredible.
And there were all kinds of designs, for sure.
All kinds of designs.
What was good?
Very, very exciting. The first award went to a project called Outside House, which included two very small pavilions, a Mauka Pavilion and a Makai Pavilion. And they structure space for living outside on agricultural land in Maui. It was selected because it was a great example of how to make a place or a structure, an architectural intervention, where land actually comes first. So it's demountable, very light frames, no walls, very minimal structures.
Oh, really? Would someone actually want to live there, though? Or is it like a tent temporary?
Well, that's why there were two pavilions, one that actually had a kitchen and a sink, and then the other one for sleeping. So yes, I think it's just it's temporary, maybe not. I think people live there. It actually is built.
Terrific.
But it's for staying in these kinds of places. And how do we, inhabit the land.
With minimal impact.
Yes.
Okay.
There were a couple of other really interesting projects. One was the second prize went to a project called Urban Market, which was a vertical farm near the Kapalama Station.
Could be part of transit-oriented development.
Yes. That's why it was located here. But actually, it was really interesting because they were proposing a place where visitors can observe hydroponic agriculture in action and also take classes in collaboration with Honolulu Community College.
Oh, a facility like that there used for education as well as growing things. There are a lot of farmers markets right in the area.
Yes.
Okay.
To be part of the neighborhood. And it was proposed by a student at the UH School of Architecture.
So your top two winners were for local projects?
Our top three winners were for local projects, yes. There was a really interesting one called Compost Playground, in which there were these interactive structures in the neighborhood that would encourage and educate about composting.
Okay. How can we put a big gold star on composting and really make it fun? I'm sure if it's possible, somebody came up with it. Thanks for kind of going over that, Carla.
You're welcome.
And that was one part of the design, but then it was the symposium. It was a day-long event at the state capitol, Simon, and I know you brought in some incredible people, resources, with ideas.
That's right. It was a really stacked schedule, and we were very fortunate to have a number of local thought leaders as well as people from the international community involved in design and involved in thinking about the value of design and engaging communities in that effort to design themselves.
What are some of those community projects that end up having multi-headed solutions, solutions for problems they didn't know they had when they went in?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question, and maybe I'll just point to, stepping back a little bit and thinking about what we thought of as what would be a mark of success for the day. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't just to bring, a few hundred people together at the state capitol, but it was to think about what comes next. And so some of those folks that were engaged in that, including Dan Patera from the Design Collaborative in Detroit, or Susanna Drake from Dylan Studio in Brooklyn, or Tim Malone, who's a landscape architect in Melbourne, or Pierre Bellanger, who's a professor at Harvard.
These are amazing people who have sort of managed to use community resources as well as they've worked with government to hairy extents to actualize community projects.
That's right, and with a real agenda for change as a key mandate for design and bringing people forward enabling them to really make some of those changes themselves. And so we had multiple perspectives from around the world. But also what I think was really useful was the wrap-up plenary conversation that involved a number of people from a community here, including Senator Donovan de la Cruz, which was moderated by Cam Napier from Pacific Business News.
Is Donovan de la Cruz a student now at the architecture school as well?
That is true.
Uh-huh. Okay. So he's somewhat invested in this design idea.
And the politics of architecture and someone with a track record of getting things done. And the idea, I think it didn't come without an agenda. The instinct was that there is some fragmentation despite all the abundance here in Hawaii and how lucky we are to be part of this place that has an abundance of energy and food and quality of life. But yet so much of that's fragmented. So
how so?
The effort was to really bring that together. And
Agencies?
I think that's right, yeah. People speaking different languages and not necessarily always agreeing on the right path forward. But the community themselves know what they need. And so like the efforts of Dan Patera in Detroit dealing with pink zoning, which is kind of a watered down version of the red tape, right? So
well,
getting
it's interesting.
Some of that out of the way.
It's the same way you designed this symposium, which was you want actionable items at the end, so therefore you work backward from there to what the thing has got to do. And so what he does is he looks at a terrific design and works backward for how the zoning has to be in order to achieve that.
Highly aspirational. Highly ambitious.
Possible here?
That's right. Absolutely. I think in particular when we look at our students who are very future focused, thinking about some really incredible partnerships that are also being formed out of this symposium. In particular, some that deal with, really large-scale issues of coastal resilience or of open space, urbanization, education, public safety.
I know what you're talking about, though, when you say even coastal resilience. Mm-hmm. You're talking about NOAA working with University of Hawaii, working with the state, working with emergency management. Isn't that the hairiest part of any kind of project, the number of constituencies?
I think so. And as long as we have a unified goal, I think it's possible to come together. And as long as we can simplify those things from their just sheer complexity.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm optimistic about the way that the students look at these problems with really smart eyes and big hearts. I think if your listeners have a chance to check out uh-cdc.org, that's the University of Hawaii Community Design Center, which will be in its inaugural year next year.
What is that?
It's led by Director Kathy Hoshar. Uh-huh. It's really an agency that's bringing these different groups together as a kind of intermediary between the community and practitioners and these larger agencies that are sometimes less apt to hit the ground running automatically, right?
Well, and it also involves doing a public service and then working backwards again for what achieving that takes. And she has helped us already. High Design has already helped us here at Hawaii Public Radio because they are assisting us to try to figure out how we're going to do a very cost-effective move for the news department into slightly roomier quarters. I mean, I hope that High Design has a terrific future interfacing the work that you do at the School of Architecture with more of how this place works and looks. Thank you so much for coming in, the both of you, Carla and Simon.
Thank you, Noe. Aloha.
Thank you. Mahalo.
All right. It's been so much such a pleasure to hear about the Building Voices Design Conference. Again, if you would tell us the website where we could look, Simon, for more information on that.
Sure. Please just visit uh-cdc.org.
Thank you. Thank you again. All right. This will be the inaugural year of partnerships between the University of Hawaii Community Design Center and several agencies, as we said. Knowing how you work, the public will also be involved. So we invite you to stay in touch. Thanks so much.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Governor Ige could be in trouble come the 2018 election. A CivilBeat.org poll shows a wide margin of Hawaii voters polled who'd prefer someone else. Editor Patty Eplert has the reasons why. Hi there.
Hello, Beth Ann.
So we hear that the approval rating is at an all-time low. How low?
His approval rating is around 35% right now, which is so we asked people, did they generally have a positive or a negative feeling about Governor Ige? And only 35% of the folks that we polled said they had a positive opinion of him.
And how many people said negative?
38%, which is slightly higher, of course. There's the margin of error of this poll is about 3.2%. So it's a little bit out of the margin of error. But there was quite a chunk of people who were unsure as well.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. It seems like there's a lot of people who don't really have an opinion.
You know, 28% were unsure, which is, you know, a healthy chunk, but not as it gets closer, of course, to an election or when people really have to start paying attention, you know, that would obviously drop. But, you know, a couple of points, I guess, is that it's a long ways to the 2018 primary in August of next year. So there's a lot still to be done. I think the interesting part, though, for us is that Governor Ige's never been wildly popular in the polls that we've done since he took office in December of 2014. And so his highest approval rating was actually around 48, I think. So not even over the 50% mark. So he's kind of he's kind of dropping in the last the longer he's governor, the more he's dropped.
So how many people said that they would prefer somebody else? I mean, we talked about a wide margin in the opening. How wide was that margin?
That is the other interesting thing. That was really significantly higher. 57% of the people that we polled said they'd rather have someone else for governor. Only 20% said that they think we should stick with Ige. Again, we're far from the time that people are actually going to have to be paying attention to this. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently about various people who might challenge Governor Ige in the primary. So I think people are sort of picking up on it a little bit.
As you look at the poll, were you able to see different sectors of people who were saying part of this? Do we know who is talking about wanting to replace Governor Ige?
He seemed to do a little bit worse among men. He did better among Filipino folks who self-identified as Filipino Americans here in Hawaii. But generally, it seems like there's a little bit of a negative vibe about him out there these days. You know, it's interesting because we've been talking about the polls all week, I think, so far. You know, he's actually more popular than Mayor Caldwell and, of course, Donald Trump in Hawaii. So he's doing a little bit better in that regard. But
well, it's nice that you can find a little bit of a silver lining in that poll. Thanks, Patty.
Thanks a lot, Beth Ann. Talk to you later.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring editor Patty Epler. Millennials have a tough time trying to figure out where they fit into the world and how the world fits into them. Earlier this year, the group Young Invincibles compared the financial health of millennials to baby boomers at the same age. This month, the IMF devoted its quarterly Finance and Development to report on the global financial status of millennials. In the issue, one senior editor wrote, quote, "Hard cognitive and social skills have always been at play, but the balance is likely to shift in favor of the latter for the 21st century. We called Hawaii economist and father of millennials, Paul Brubaker, to get his take on the various reports. We talked earlier today to cross-check some of the findings.
A couple things jump out. I mean, the biggest one that jumped out when I was reading the study based on the Fed's consumer spending survey was that there is so much college debt associated with their young adult lives. Otherwise, as I say, the data are interesting, but they're not as surprising to me as they might be to people who aren't familiar with these kinds of data.
Why are you not surprised, and why would you encourage us perhaps not to be surprised either?
Well, when I say not surprised, I mean that there are other things going on in the economy that help explain them that we should be concerned about that aren't necessarily specific to the millennial generation.
And yet there are things about growing up in the time that millennials came of age that has decidedly shifted. To compare money that a millennial would be making today to what a baby boomer parent made at the same age, say in 1989, is somewhat disingenuous. Would you agree with that?
Well, the nature of the economy generally has changed dramatically, and that's at the foundation of many of the differences that I see in the data. So millennials have higher home ownership than boomers did at the same age. Millennials have higher savings, have larger retirement accounts than boomers did at the same age, and they're more likely to be saving for retirement. So you could explain both of those with changes in the nature of financial intermediation. For example, mortgage credit is much more accessible than it was 30 years ago. And just that increase in access alone could explain the rather small difference between the generations at the same stages in life. But with retirement savings, it's changed even more dramatically. So, for example, more companies today offer automatic savings options, 401ks and whatnot. And there, there's some interesting economic research that suggests people save more when you automate it, it's a decision that they have to opt out of.
Some of the things that you're talking about have a lot to do with whether or not a person went to college and is still dealing with debt. And so looking at issues like savings and home ownership and comparing that to baby boomers is, in fact, dependent upon whether or not that person went to college. In aggregate, what we're told is that millennials are making significantly less, about 20% less, than what their baby boomer parents did at the same age in, say, 1989.
Yeah, so let's see if I can tie those things together, because I think independently, maybe they give an impression that's not the right impression. So, for example, the point I made earlier is that the structure of financial intermediation has made savings and wealth accumulation more accessible. And that's a general phenomenon. That's not something that just affected boomers. Single moms can get a mortgage easier today than they could 30 years ago. So that's a good thing. With respect to educational attainment, I don't think there's that much difference in educational attainment across the two generations. Again, the structure of the economy has changed over the last 30 or 40 years, and that probably explains some of the outcomes we're talking about. For example, the person with higher educational attainment today makes way more than persons without that attainment, and way more than persons with the same amount of educational attainment 30 or 40 years ago. A high school dropout, in contrast, not only makes less than a person with higher educational attainment, but a high school dropout today earns less than a high school dropout 30 or 40 years ago. And that's because the structure of the economy has changed in a way that persons with higher educational attainment are able to use the technology that makes us productive, but persons without higher educational attainment tend not to have the critical thinking and analytical skills that make it possible to really exploit modern information technology in particular, and the machines are more likely to be a substitute for the workers. So that's a change in the nature of technology that's affected everybody, because younger adults, right, persons in their 20s, let's say, are right at the stage in life where they're sorting their educational attainment differentials out. Some are acquiring skills. Others are checking out or graduating and stopping their educations or whatever. Those differences aren't going to show up as profoundly as will be the case for persons 30 years later, where the big payoff to higher education is. And so if you sample younger people today, you'll tend to pick up more of the disadvantage of not having achieved higher educational attainment. So the advice I would give as an economist is keep going to school, number one. But second, wait a couple decades, and you'll see some of those payoffs start to show up, right? For persons in their 20s haven't really begun to experience the benefits of higher education that they will down the road. But the particular nature of the economy today is that it penalizes you if you don't finish school. And 40 years ago, you could join an industrial union and make a good wage in an occupation that nowadays is probably elsewhere in the country or in which you've been replaced by robots.
Paul, you're the dad of millennials.
What do you
tell your kids these days as they tell you what they're facing in the world?
You know, with my kids, as with a lot of parents, they had to discover most of what I thought I was already telling them on their own. You know, eventually they all finished higher education of some sort. And eventually they moved on from what they thought were going to be the kinds of occupations that they'd want, but only because they were too young to realize that there were other dimensions, and they slowly figured that out on their own. So I don't think that's any different from any other generation per se. But again, the context is different. The nature of the, right, everybody today has a cell phone. You know, think, go back 40 years and think about that for a second. when I teach up at UH, I'm always surprised. I think I was the only person in my class this spring semester that actually took the bus to UH. Everybody seems to have a car. So the world is just different in some ways that reflect the nature of productivity growth and technological change and where it's brought the economy. And in many ways, you know, we have these devices and we have these technologies that, you know, make the world a better place and an easier place to get around. And millennials have benefited from that. But they've also had to carry the burden of some of the other things that have changed in society. And the one I'm most concerned about is the amount of indebtedness associated with higher education that seems to be showing up in the data that didn't exist a generation ago. At any rate, my boys, fortunately, knock on wood, right, they didn't have to take out a bunch of college loans to get through through school. You know, one of the other things I'm concerned about with this college debt statistic, one thing we didn't have 30 or 40 years ago is all these fake colleges like Trump University, and they're not cheap.
Yeah.
And they're like student loan mills, right? If I understand the racket, they basically talk you into getting a large loan to go to a bad school and get a junk degree. So that may be showing up in these data.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks, Bethann.
Paul Brubaker is an economist with TZ Economics, a consulting firm that focuses on analysis of Hawaii's economy. The Young Invincibles report on the generational declines between baby boomers and millennials, and the link to the IMF magazine's June issue devoted to millennial finance are on our website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
And now we've got the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we took you to the Pu'uloa petroglyphs in Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island. The site is covered with over 23,000 carvings and is considered sacred. An elevated boardwalk protects the carvings, allowing visitors to get a good view, but not to do any damage. Although Hawaiians chiseled images of everything from turtles to canoe sails, it also recorded travel around the island. Most of the carvings were just simple circles and holes. Each puka was carved to mark a birth of a child. But it wasn't just a genealogical record. It was also a hope for the baby's longevity. And that's why the area's name translates to Long Hill or Hill of Long Life. In 1914, anthropologist Martha Beckwith found that after carving the holes, a particular and singular object was placed inside, and we asked you if you knew what those little repositories held. The answer? The baby's umbilical cord.
We had a winner on that, Bethann. Michelle Grotstein of Kaneohe. Congratulations. Thanks for calling.
And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Marcus Hanalei Marzan has degrees in fiber arts and museum studies. He's been Bishop Museum's cultural resource specialist since about 2008, and his kuleana encompasses traditional techniques and cultural practices and their application today. Marcus, it's so great to have you in here.
Aloha nui. Thank you for having me.
It's been quite an exciting year for you.
It has.
You had a fabulous show at the Pa'i Art Gallery there at Kalia with Solomon Enos. Terrific showing at the Honolulu Biennial.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. Some of the most amazing works. And I'm so proud to have you here today talking about how some of these great Native Hawaiian techniques are brought into the present. You started with Lohala?
Correct. In 1996, when I was still in high school, I took a Lohala weaving class during the summer, and it just sparked my creativity in multiple different ways.
Why?
Well, I always wanted to learn how to weave Lohala ever since I was a little boy. My great-grandmother was a Lohala weaver, and my mother cared for a number of things that she had made. And I was always fascinated
things
by
like
looking at them, Lohala hats, and she made quilts and other things. And my mother was able to care for them in our family house, and I was surrounded by it my entire time growing up. So I was always inspired to try and find out how she made those kinds of things. And when that Lohala class came up during that summer of when I was in high school, I just decided to take a chance, and it just started from there.
Geez, a few years later, you did get the State Foundation on Culture and Arts apprenticeship with Master Weaver Esther Kakalia Westmoreland.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing experience to sit down and spend a lot of time with a kupuna and hearing her stories, hearing her different experiences with the materials and other weaving techniques.
What's particular about Lohala? Tell us a little about that.
Lohala, it's an amazing material. It's very durable, very pliable. You can use it in multiple ways. The way that I first learned how to use it was to make it into woven materials, so baskets and fans and bracelets and mats.
So it's actually leaves of a hala tree.
Leaves of the pandanus tree.
Pandanus.
That are dried and stripped to the varying sizes that are needed to make whatever project that you're working on at that moment.
How long can this possibly last, this material?
Many of these examples still exist in families and some in museums around the world. So generations within families, for instance, my great-grandmother's hats have been in my family for at least 60 years. And
really?
They look just as good as they would have when she first made them. So it's just depends on how one cares for them, and if they're protected from the elements and in that way. So it's a very strong, durable, and resilient fiber.
Amazing. You've worked with so many different Hawaiian textiles and materials, sennet, kapa, but I don't think people can really imagine what some of your works have looked like, Marcus.
So as you mentioned a little earlier in the Honolulu Biennial, I did do a installation work that incorporated all of those materials, Lohala, sennet, kapa, and different techniques. So
midribs of coconut.
Midribs of coconuts.
Yeah, that really get some height there, because we're talking about things that look like fantastic things you would see on a Paris or New York runway.
Correct.
Things that really add dimension and height to a model.
Very much so. And I'm always into trying to accentuate and bring out the natural beauty of the material themselves. So to really have the material showcase their best face and the qualities that they exhibit.
Do you find you've traveled and exhibited across the Pacific? Do you find they use these natural materials in a similar way?
I think so. A lot of the people within the Pacific have a similar common ancestry and cultural value system. So the idea of using the materials that are available to you and enhancing their qualities in the products that you create is very common across the Pacific. And I'm very happy to see that the tradition is quite alive and well in so many areas that one would think that it wouldn't be as profitable or convenient in the present time.
I know. Certainly, you've got to have a reason to go through what it takes with some of these materials. Kappa,
definitely,
for example.
Definitely. It's so labor intensive.
And it's all
so
tied in with
processes.
The culture.
Very much. It's tied into the culture and tied into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The environment is so important. The materials can only grow in certain conditions, and if those conditions aren't available, those materials won't be available for the practitioners to create those works. So taking care of the environment is a very important part of this process of creation of works.
Mm. As you see the costumes, for example, in Merry Monarch, as they morph every year in different, do you think that they are generally authentic in the kahiko section?
I think the tradition of using materials and what was available to you is consistent to what has been practiced all the way up until the present. You know, we've been large hoop skirts.
Top of the,
yeah, definitely. You know, and even the use of modern materials. Our kupuna were very creative and innovative people, and I think we are still much the same way. We use the materials that are available to us, and I think a lot of the young people today, though, are really trying to reconnect to their roots and their values and systems, and the best way to do that is go back to those traditional practices and traditional materials that can really ground oneself in those perspectives and ideas and the stories of our kupuna.
Even in what it takes environmentally to make
Correct.
Sure it happens. Wow, what a linkage. And you know what's neat? Marcus Marzan is the featured artist in the most recent edition of Bamboo Ridge, the Journal of Hawaii Literature and Arts. It's Bamboo Ridge edition 110. And he's got a terrific layout of some of his most signature works, as well as the cover of this Bamboo Ridge. And it's all going to be celebrated in an event that's coming up this Saturday. It's second Saturday, June 10th, there at the Louis Pohl Gallery, where you do have a show going on right now, Marcus.
Correct.
I'm so excited about this program. It's called Koko Ula, the Cherished Carrying Net. And everyone's invited to be there on Saturday, this coming Saturday, for a reading by Bamboo Ridge authors. This issue here was edited by Donald Carrera Ching and Misty Sanico. It features also, this coming Saturday, a weaving demonstration by Marcus.
Correct. So the weaving demonstration and readings will take place from 1 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the exhibition runs until the 28th of July.
Terrific. It's great. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having
me.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's season finale with Otomo and Watts. Andre Watts performs Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 this Saturday and Sunday. More at hisymphony.org.
So much going on in the 50th state. Morning Edition host and colleague here, Derek Malamas, joining us for a look at events possibly under the radar.
Yes, they are. There is a big feast planned for tomorrow in the Arts at Mark's Garage. Don't know if you know about this one.
No, I haven't heard about this one.
Okay, a FEAST is an acronym for Funding Emerging Art with Sustainable Tactics. It's an event that uses community-driven funds to help emerging art makers, and FEAST attendees pay for a catered reception, and a portion of that payment will be set aside as a prize. During dinner, three artists will explain their proposed public art project, and the attendees will then vote on which artist's project gets the prize.
Which is the funding for that. That's
right,
terrific.
I know. So part of your dinner goes to the funding for this public art project. And this is happening tomorrow from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Arts at Mark's Garage. And for ticket information, just go to our website.
Oh, that is terrific,
yeah,
Derek.
I know. What a fun idea.
Thanks for telling us about that one.
Sure.
Neighbor Islands, you got anything?
An exhibition in Hilo explores a topic some may consider lonely this month. The East Hawaii Cultural Center presents the 2017 Hawaii Photography exhibit called Isolation. And this exhibit explores the theme of isolation through the lenses of 25 contemporary photographers from Hawaii Island and beyond. And the photos are on display through July 1st at the East Hawaii Cultural Center in Hilo.
Great. Oh, geez, that's a lovely little building to stop by, too. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Derek.
Sure.
He joins the conversation to take a closer look at some of the events going on around this community that might be just a tad under your radar. You can always find out more at our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Aloha, this is Will Shorts, Puzzle Master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele, inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion with our guests, Lake Street Dive, Irish comic Maeve Higgins, Nashville's Margot Price, and yes, the one, the only Mr. Jack White. All this plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, that's Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, also my Song of the Week. And the First Call Radio Players will be there, and you'll just have to tune in.
Here are Prairie Home Companions, Saturday evening at 6.
We're moving up to the noon hour, and it's time for us to say goodbye, at least until tomorrow. And we're going to get a different take on the pullout from the Paris Accord from someone just back from the EU.
Sounds good. Plus, we'll have John Richards, Dean of Hospitality, in charge of KCC's culinary program, and they're really stepping out these days. He'll tell us about a culinary jazz theater collaboration that's coming this weekend.
If you'd like to comment about anything that you hear on the program or on the station, you can always be in touch via our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217. Or you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you want to say hello to me, and I will tweet back, find me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed part of The Conversation or any other show that we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Check it out. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Let's meet up tomorrow for more of The Conversation.